thank you, everyone. And that's my opening spiel. I'll head it over to my team today and my speakers, Alexis Rourke.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Bear
Thanks
with
so
us for a
much.
second as we pull up the presentation.
Okay, thank you. In the meantime, I just want to welcome everybody. Thank you so much for coming. I see we have a smaller group here for one of our webinars, but you know what? It's 10 days from the end of the fiscal year, and we are so happy that you've chosen to take this time with us and just hear a little bit about the Superfund redevelopment program. My name is Alexis Rourke Reyes. I work in the Superfund redevelopment. I manage the program from headquarters, but we have regional partners in the regions and my counterparts in the regions, all of them, and one of them is here today. So I'm really happy for you all to hear from Tom Bloom. I think we're going to have good time for question and answers later too, so please stick around for that. And then we'll also have another RPM, Dion Novak, or I'm sorry, Tom is the redevelopment coordinator for Region 5. And then we have Dion Novak, who's our RPM. You may know him as a NARPM co-chair from Region 5, who's going to come on in a little bit and talk about a particular case study. Many thanks to, we had a presenter, another one from Region 6, who's one of our redevelopment coordinators. You'll hear what that means in a bit, who was out with a sick kiddo today. So we're thinking of him and really glad that Tom and Dion are here. And oh, great. It looks like we have 43 people. Okay. So yeah, I won't ask Tom or Dion to come on camera, but you'll see them in a little bit. And I think we wanted to start with a poll, if we could, just to get a sense of who you all are at. We don't get to see you, but we want to know at least, famous question that they ask at every NARPM session, true to NARPM form, how many years have you worked in Superfund program? So if you could take a sec to just give us a sense of that, that would be great. And then we can kind of see where we're at. And I can't vote, but I'll let you know. I've been in the program for less than 2 years. I've been at EPA longer, but I still have a lot to learn. Is the poll working for folks?
Yes, I am
Okay, great.
seeing, yeah, most people, 91% have participated. So,
Cool. Okay.
yeah. You
Don't
want to go
think.
ahead and end that
Yeah.
poll? I think that's enough.
Yeah. That's good. That's an easy question. So.
Yeah. Can you see
Okay.
the results?
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you. So it looks like we have about 66% of folks, two-thirds or so, less than 2 years. That's great. Welcome. Welcome to EPA and Superfund. And then couple, that 2 to 5 or 5 to 10 years, and then we have a few that have been here for more than 10 years. So I will love to hear what you think as well and what exposure you've had to Superfund redevelopment in your time here. Hopefully we can get to some of that later. For now we can close the poll and go on to the next slide, and just to give you guys a sense of what we're going to be talking about today. So no surprise, main topic is the program itself. But in addition to having you all, understand what the program is, we want to make sure that to explain why it's important and the impact that it has, because that's really what keeps us all doing this work and keeps us feeling really excited about it, even after Tom, who's been working on this for over 20 years, is still just as enthusiastic, and we I think for good reason. Then we also want to get into some tools and support for Superfund redevelopment. We'll share a couple of case studies so you can start to get an idea of what the Superfund redevelopment kind of reuse planning assistance is really like and what some of the outcomes can be. And then we will do a recap and make sure that you know above anything else how you can get started with the program on sites that you're managing. So, and all the pictures in these slides are real Superfund sites that are in reuse. So anything, all these things that you see here are possible. It's some of the most trickiest sites out there. If you want to go to the next slide. Oh, I'm sorry. Are we gonna do the video now? Great, let's do the video. Okay, this is a video from Region 5. I hope that it will work. We'll see from this Sandy Joe site.
It was Earth Day, an Earth Day
On
celebration.
Earth Day. Thanks, Tom.
Yes.
We'll see about the sound. That can be tricky. I'm
No
not
sound.
hearing it. Is anyone else hearing it?
Yeah. Sorry, Lynette. You might have to reshare and click to include audio.
Okay, let's give that a try. And if not, we will put the link to this because this is a public video on Google or something. Let's see.
Just as Earth Day has transformed the way that we view environmental affairs, Earth Day in 2023, we're going to engage in a true transformation. And that transformation is happening because at the beginning of this administration, we decided to reimagine as we rebuild our city. That's what this site today is all about.
You know, this 50-acre site 40 years ago was abused and became contaminated with hazardous waste as part of the M&M landfill. Since that time and decades later, the US EPA, the City of Gary, the Indiana Department of Environmental Management, and a whole lot of people have worked very hard to protect the site, to protect public health, and to eventually, like today, bring it back into productive use. We're very excited about returning this site to economic prosperity while we also protect our citizens from legacy environmental contamination. So one of the great features about this redevelopment was to be able to incorporate the natural environment that we have here in Gary into the economic development of the site. So the site developer has set aside 4 acres to the west to be preserved and to be enhanced for stormwater development, to continue to have trees to buffer the site, and to add to the aesthetics and the sustainable nature of the redevelopment in general. And so this is a win-win for the economy, for the environment, for the people of Gary, and for social change throughout this entire city.
Thank you. I love watching that. I was actually just yesterday in Norfolk, Virginia at a reuse celebration and award that Region 3 gave to folks very similar setup, you know, some folks that were at EPA working with the US Army Corps of Engineers cleaning up a site and did so working with developers who ended up installing a huge logistics center there, you know, bringing lots of jobs to the community. They did it within a really sustainable way. We actually got to tour the facility, all sustainable electric machinery, trees planted outside. So there's so many things that are possible. If we go to the next slide, well, you'll see, and thanks for the video. If you go to, yeah, so these are real sites, all these things, you know, and so that's what our mission is about. I feel really lucky that I get to have this job and help site teams, you know, because that's really where it starts, is having you all as, you know, if you're RPMs or CICs or attorneys or risk assessors, all kinds of roles that of folks that within EPA that we work with. And what we really want to do is just have you understand what this program can do, and just let you know that, you know, even if you're new to EPA and you inherited a site that's been around for million years and all the decision documents are done and already, you know, filed away, oh, it's never too late to think about reuse potential or to revisit with the community what folks are interested in seeing, to work with local governments and to have those discussions. I say it's never too late, but there is a best practice, of course. So, you know, the ideal time to do it is if you do have a newly listed site, and as the ROD or as the remedial investigation is happening, to do something called a reuse assessment. We'll get into that a little bit more, but you know, that's best practice. But don't despair if you are finding yourself working with a site that's later on in the process. There is always opportunity, and you know, just to remember that. As you guys know, as EPA staff, we don't own the sites, we don't control even the zoning or anything like that, but we can still play a role. And so we just hope that you guys will we'll remember that. Let's go to the next slide. Thank you. Okay. And the way that I know this is possible is because we have people like these people to support you. Every region, we are looking for somebody actually in region 2 and region 9 to backfill after some transitions, but generally in the regions we have people there who are standing by and really knowledgeable and really excited about this work. Some of them are RPMs and do this kind of as a another one of the hats that they wear. Some people are like Tom or Jackie Kondrick in region 3, who this is kind of their whole week is taken up by this work. And you know, everybody is plenty busy. There's a lot of people out there in terms of private sector folks and local governments that want to do this work. And so when you get approached by people, these are the folks within EPA in your regional office that are there to help you. And I really, if nothing else, you know, this we'll cover this again, but just recommend that you get to know them, that you reach out to them, that you share ideas when you get inquiries from people wanting to buy a site or wanting to do something, that you kind of talk with these folks. They're always there for you, and they know how to access the resources of Superfund Redevelopment Program in terms of actually funding to do some of this planning work. But with that, let's keep going. The next slide, please. Okay, thank you. And so just like you saw in this video, I think the woman speaking was outlining some of the benefits that they felt that they were going to see in Gary, which was, you know, a lot of times about economic development. And that's important. And we actually have really good data that we collect every year for all the regions in terms of what is happening on sites that are being reused. We know that at 671 of the sites that are reused, there's actually over 1,000 in reuse, but it's hard to get this data, but it's very accurate. And so in these 671 sites that we can really confidently say we know what's going on, this is the number of businesses that are operating. This is the number of folks that are employed, and they're bringing home income. They're bringing home billions of dollars of income to their communities and to their families. In terms of, like, if you want to look on the right side in the revenue chart, you're thinking about, you know, from a government perspective, thinking how much EPA and public and taxpayers pay for these cleanups to happen. It's magnified many times over by the value that is brought in economic development to reusing these sites. And so it really does help kind of close that loop of all that public investment that went into things and deliver some really significant benefits. So if you want, you can go on to the next slide. I guess before I go on, I'm sorry, I wanted to say one more thing, but you can keep it on this slide. Just that the community benefits from this too. You know, they benefit economically. As the person mentioned in that video, they also benefit for the environmental and the health benefits. There are so many sites out there that are being used for ecosystem services, for recreation spaces, for, you know, conserved place, wildlife habitat. And we have a new report. We'll put out the link to it later on that talks about some of those benefits as well. And then just environmental justice, you know, obviously having a Superfund site in where you live, and, you know, 73 million people do live near a Superfund site, and having, you know, dealt with kind of the repercussions of that, not only in terms of health, but, you know, also in terms of potentially stigma on your community, this work really helps address those environmental issues. And there's environmental justice issues and wells, and we feel really good about that too. So, okay. So we can go to the next slide. We were here actually. I'm sorry, stay here. And just to echo again, you know, environmental justice is not just a priority that we have in our federal administration right now, but it's really meaningful to local communities and local stakeholders and local governments. And so one of the ways that I like to think about environmental justice is just the how that we do things. And so involving communities in reuse and redevelopment is a really important how to do that the right way that delivers benefits that are really meaningful to folks. And so we just wanted to take a second to talk about that, because I think that is really what can make all the difference between delivering resources back to communities in terms of, you know, new job centers, new amenities, new community facilities, transit, all those things, and making that connection to have it be something that the community really needs and really, really wants. And that's how we hope to influence that. We can go to the next slide, please. Thank you. Okay. And so hopefully you all are kind of familiar with this process. You know, we're just getting started. Maybe you've been through certain parts of it already in terms of, you know, the cleanup process overall in a remedial site. And what we wanted to show here is just that reuse comes into play all throughout. So as I mentioned earlier, we're talking, you know, in the RI remedial investigation stage, when we look at reuse, that informs what the cleanup options can be and risk assessment exposure scenarios. If you have a sense of what people are going to be doing there later, it's really important to factor in. Also in the plan, you know, pre-ROD and thinking about how what cleanup alternatives are, what the design or not the design just yet, but, you know, what some of the big picture outcomes that you all want to do in terms of remediation and how those align with the community's interests. Then as you're looking into the design and implementing the design through remedial action, thinking about ways that that you can keep that future use that you know about because you've done that work in the beginning, and keep that in mind as you're doing the design and carrying out the implementation. And then of course, you know, one of the things that we do in our office too is we're the data sponsor for the SWARU, the site-wide ready for anticipated use performance measure. And so that's another important milestone that is kind of comes along with reuse and redevelopment, just being ready for that and knowing that you've checked a lot of boxes in terms of institutional controls and construction work and other precautions that are in place and human exposure to be able to be ready for reuse. I will say you do not have to, your site does not have to have achieved SWARU to be able to be reused or to be continued to be used. But I just did want to make that note. And because when we start talking about resources later, because we do also support the SWARU measure, we also have some additional resources in terms of technical support that can help with that too. So your next slide, please. Okay. And hopefully now also you are familiar with when we're talking about developing a ROD, a record of decision, this term called reasonably anticipated future land use. So that's RAFLU. So that's one of the key concepts that we want to kind of drive home for everybody. It is required as part of the ROD. And it's also required that it's to be informed by something called a reuse assessment. And so that's something that we can also support your site team with. And just like you do a community involvement plan and other kinds of pre-research and pre-work as the ROD is being developed and the site's being investigated, you also develop a kind of a recommendation on the reasonably anticipated future land use. And if you do that, the better informed you are about what people want in the community, what the local government wants, what the property owner intentions are, you can make a reasonably anticipated future land use, a RAFLU determination that is really aligned with that, And that again goes into the record of decisions. So it will be considered very carefully throughout all the other aspects of the cleanup process. And so that's a really important step that we want to drive home, as I was saying earlier, is kind of a best practice. I won't say more about that now. We'll go to the next slide, please. Another way that, you know, in terms of best practices, that you should be thinking about reuse as kind of part of your overall process is when you're thinking about your site's conceptual site model. And so, as you can see, we borrowed this diagram from that handbook that talks about the conceptual site model, and thinking about intended reuse is right up there with geology and hydrology and, you know, potential remedies and pathway receptors. It's really important to keep in mind as you're going through that process. And so hopefully this will start, depending on where you are in your kind of required trainings for Superfund, hopefully you'll be thinking about this and have the opportunity to dig in a little bit more as you do it. But in the meantime, let's go to a poll, I think is our next slide. All right. I tried to say it, I stumbled over it a little bit, but I hope you still remember. What does RAFLU stand for? Okay, I don't think we need to give, let's give people like 10 more seconds. I like these options. And I hope we've made it easy for you.
We're at 100%.
Oh, right. Okay, let's see. What our results are.
All right.
Okay. Well, good. Okay. I think it kind of drove the point home for most. Reasonably anticipated future land use. So it's not the land use that was before. It's future. Seems like that's the operative word here. Reasonably anticipated future land use for RAFLU. Okay. Thank you. Let's go to the next slide. And I think at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Tom, but let me triple check here if I'm pinch hitting a little bit. Okay. Yes. So now I'm going to turn it over to Tom Bloom, Region 5, very near and dear and very experienced and generous with his experience on redevelopment. So I'll let him talk about reuse assessment. Thanks.
You're just saying that because I talk a lot.
You're generous. You're generous. Yeah.
Generous, I can't shut up. I'm going to talk about a couple of tools that we have in our EPA guidance for helping determine reasonably anticipated future land uses. One of them is the reuse assessment, and the other one is reuse planning, and I'd like to talk about both of them and tell you the difference between them. First of all, the reuse assessment, and the guidance that defines reuse assessment as a part of the remedial process that involves collecting and evaluating information to develop assumptions about reasonably anticipated future land uses at site. And the scope and level of the detail of the reuse assessment should be specifically tailored to the complexity of the site, the extent of contamination, the level of redevelopment activity that's already occurred, and the density of the development around the site. The reuse assessment is a fundamental part of the site's cleanup process because it involves collecting information about assumptions for reasonably anticipated future land use. And it's appropriate to use Superfund funding to determine the reasonably anticipated future land use and to fund reuse assessments. Reuse assessments are a required part of the process to determine reasonably anticipated future land use. And it informs the risk assessment. It leads to calculations for cleanup levels, as well as the site's overall strategy. Reuse assessments may involve review of available records, visual inspections of the site, definitely a site visit, discussions about reasonably anticipated future land uses with local government officials, property owners, community members, potential developers in the area. We can involve visioning exercises for the community, different visual techniques to assist the reuse stakeholders in considering and exploring future uses at the site. The reuse assessment develops assumptions in broad categories like commercial, industrial, recreational, and ecological. Reuse assessment should be part of the admin record because it helps us choose the a consensus-driven future land use that's not just relying on zoning ordinances and adjacent land uses, but what the community and what the local stakeholders would like for the site. I have just a quick example where we had a steel mill that was going to be cleaned up along the Little Miami River, where the responsible party saw it was zoned as industrial. Everybody said it was industrial. But when we looked at the city's or the land use authority's comprehensive plan, it showed a river walk to the north, a river walk to the south, and it truncated right at the site. We asked the responsible parties to assess that river area for recreational uses because of this plan. It wasn't dirty. They didn't have to clean it up. But we were able to then make that a part of the city's comprehensive plan. It was protective them for them to use. And then they redesigned the river walk so they can connect the two. And that's something we would have never known about if we didn't do the reuse assessment. So that's what I wanted to tell you about that. Can I have the next slide, please? So a reuse plan is a little different. It's kind of an optional part of the process. It's stakeholder driven. A lot of times when we have sites, there'll be a champion out at the site or a group of champions that want to have something done out there. They see the sites laying there vacant. They see it's blighted. People are breaking in and they want to champion the cause. So they contact the project manager, the on-scene coordinator, or they sometimes contact the redevelopment coordinator and they ask for some assistance. And so that's where we come up with the reuse plan. It's really beneficial for the EPA and the community to kind of get together. It helps us to explain how the reasonably anticipated future land use process works to the community. It's a possible catalyst for remedial action. Sometimes a developer will shake out of the bushes and want to carve out part of the site to do and actually clean it up and do some work on that part of the site before the rest of it is done. As Alexis mentioned earlier, that we can help also target our remedial process to focus on specific results of the reuse plans and clean up to that kind of a cleanliness and cleanup level, establishes realistic expectations for the community too. When we educate them as to what the site was about, what we think we can do with it, strengthens the relationships between the communities and EPA. We can sometimes put in environmental and smart growth benefits into our plans, and it definitely enhances long-term stewardship. When you engage the community, you've got eyes and ears on your site. People break in the fence, people get their all-terrain vehicles driving around in a cab, you're going to know about it. If you don't have anybody in the community that's really caring about the site, you might not know about it for several weeks or so like that. So it's really beneficial when we get the community involved and put together reuse plans. A well-run, site-specific, community-based driven reuse plan has potential to do a bunch of great things. Some of the plans cover about six different steps. The first step is kind of building political support and establishing legitimacy for reuse planning process, letting the local stakeholders know what the process is about, what they can expect, how much level of effort they're going to have to put into it. It involves site research and analysis, community involvement, education, and capacity building. Conceptual site reuse framework model will come out of the process, and identification of other resources that can help fund maybe cleanup or not cleanup, but let's say the redevelopment of the site, grants or so. And a project report is normally produced out of that. Now, if somebody comes to you and you're a project manager or on-scene coordinator and asks you about this reuse planning and stuff, you don't have to do it. You're not doing it yourself. You come and talk to me. We get our reuse consultant Scale Solutions on board, and we help facilitate the whole thing. You're more like a resource that's helping us move through this process. I wanted to say a little bit about the history of real quick. I know I'm over on my talk. I always am. The program started as a cooperative agreement program in 1999, like a Brownfields grant program, where municipalities were given $100,000 if they had a Superfund site within their jurisdiction that was in the RI phase. They were given that $100,000 to hire consultants to put on neighborhood charrettes to get the community's input so they could inform the remedy through a conceptual plan. That happened in 1999. There was 10 of them. 2000, there was 40 of them. By 2001, 2002, there was no funding for it anymore. It wasn't a cooperative agreement grant availability. So we turned to in-kind services. Alexis's predecessor had a contractor called Ecology and Economics that they had on board. and Ecology and Economic Eats Inc. out of Charlottesville, Virginia. Then they were our reuse consultants. When a city would come to me and say, "Hey, we need some help here with reuse planning or reuse assessment," I would bring I wouldn't have them apply for a cooperative agreement grant. I would bring E-Squared Inc., our contractors, go and work with them. And it kind of helped it out the program quite a bit when we went to in-kind services, because we could work on sites that were in P-Corps, preliminary closeout, and we could work on sites that were fiber reviews, not just RIFS sites. Sometimes there would just be like an administrative barrier, like something in the institutional control that would prohibit reuse. And we could remove that barrier through an ESD. The developer and the local city people would want to use the site. So that really helped to fit our services more to the stakeholders' needs and goals. I think that's about it for me. I'm going to turn it over to somebody to talk about the Colorado smelter case study.
Okay. Thanks, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much. See you about generosity, folks. He is, and I always learn something when I talk.
I'm verbose, and I know I went over my 5 minutes.
No, you're good. I'm happy. Listen, this is an internal webinar, and I want people to get the benefit of getting to talk with you. And hopefully we'll have some time for that at the end, too. But yeah, in the meantime, you know, talking about reuse planning, again, it's not the required part, but it's a part that can deliver so much value. All the things that Tom was talking about in terms of these close relationships with the community, doing these processes, helping them identify resources that they can use to implement their own vision, having good stewards on the site. I feel like this is a really good case study. I wish that the person who actually has gone through the process, her name's Sabrina Forrest, Region 8, she actually just won RPM of the year, and probably in part for some of this work, because what she's been doing is working on the Colorado smelter site so closely for years on doing this reuse planning, which is, you know, it's an ongoing process. And you see here on the slide, you know, there are some things to be aware of. It's not necessarily always a quick process. It depends, but it's something that really can deepen your relationships and the things that you can do to bring value to the communities that you're working in, and really helps them create some value. We'll hear about that a little bit later as well with another case study. But the reason we wanted to highlight this one is because this is the pre-ROD that we were talking about. Before you've decided on what you're going to do, before the community's kind of accepted that plan, this is an example of how you can kind of do all that legwork ahead of time and really come out with something that that serves the community's needs. So in Colorado, Pueblo, Colorado, it was a neighborhood that was born out, probably like many Superfund neighborhoods. It kind of built up around this industry. In this case, it was steel. So it attracted people from all over the world, a lot of Italian people, Slovenia, Mexico, and it has a really rich history, and that's evident. You can see some of the photos here, and that's something that really brings people and, you know, have people kind of treasure their own community despite the issues that they have. You know, in addition to having contaminated soil from the industry that they hosted, they also have a lack of investment. So they, you know, housing issues, infrastructure, they don't have enough services for their people and economic development. And so in addition to kind of, you know, EPA adding this list to the NPL and trying to address, you know, huge issues of arsenic and lead and surrounding community properties, EPA also formed, you guys are hopefully familiar through our community involvement program, there's something called a community advisory group. And so that group was actually really active in this reuse planning process in the site. This was almost 10 years ago now, but it continues to be an evolving process. And so they don't all have to be like that, but they can, especially these larger sites that have different operable units, and you can kind of focus on them at one unit at a time, or whatever makes sense for your overall remedial process. But what, you know, what Region 8 did is, again, requested support from headquarters. You see on the second bullet here, it says headquarters regional reuse seeds. That's what we call kind of our technical assistance project. We'll talk about that a little bit more later, but they basically requested technical assistance. And so we had our consultant team head out and convene some working sessions with community leaders that wanted to look at the land use considerations and the inventory of, and just kind of get a sense of all the different projects that were happening around the community so that whatever the Superfund program was doing could really support that. And so, because they were pre-ROD, they were able to use all that information that they collected through public meetings and visioning sessions, which are sessions where community members come together to kind of express what they're interested in seeing in their communities and usually have some kind of facilitation support to be able to turn that into something like this, which I think, oh, is it blurring? I wanted to print this out to show you, but we'll put a link in the chat, but this is like the final report that I think it's blurry, so that's goofy, sorry. But yeah, there it is in the chat. Thank you, Reedon. This is an example of one of the deliverables that can come out of a process like this, and you'll see that it's not independent from Superfund. It's a way to integrate all the considerations of Superfund and, you know, keeping a site protected, keeping people protected, and being able to address some of the needs that people are interested in seeing. And so when you have a plan like that, it really helps people in the local community be able to go into meetings with their government, with their state government, with people that can help them find funding to implement some of their goals. And it really just gets them on better footing for that. And that's what we want to do. We want to, you know, they've invested a lot in their community. And as Tom mentioned, that's a really great way to get them kind of invested in the site and the stewardship of the site. And so we want to support them as much as possible. This particular group is keeping on going. You should keep up with it. I'm sure we'll profile it again because it's a really exciting one. But there are many, many like this. We actually are about early next year planning to complete the 500th project like this that we've been doing around the country. So that's really cool. And we'll come back with more stories then. But in the meantime, we can go to the next slide. Quiz for you guys, a poll. Okay. I tried to say it a couple of times. We're going to see how this went. True or false? Reuse assessments are... Oh, I thought this was the reuse assessment poll. But that's okay. We can... Do we have one of those?
It is. It is the reuse assessment.
It is? I see number three. I received a call from a developer that is interested in a site that I manage. Mm-hmm.
Which I'm seeing true or false reuse assessment.
You are? Yeah. Okay, well, either way, it's true. Reuse assessments are required. Reuse plans are optional and very encouraged by us. We have lots of great examples for you to see and also, you know, just feel comfortable that even though we have all these examples, we're still trying new things out all the time in terms of the best ways to engage communities, the best ways to get them resources, help them get hooked up with partners that can help with implementation. And so the examples keep going. And we'll keep that other poll for a little bit later on. So for now, I'm going to turn. I see him here. I saw his name. We have Dion Novak from Region 5. Thank you, Dion, so much. He's been such a champion of reuse for many years, many longer than I've been working on it. So you guys are in good hands, and he's going to share a case study about the Riley Tar and Chemical Corp.
Hey, Alexis, and I will not go over my time, Tom.
Okay.
I just want you to know that.
Okay. You can turn your
this
camera.
This was a, even though he's in my region, I have to harass him. The Riley Tar site is in Indianapolis. It's a former wood preserver and current, for a couple more weeks, specialty chemical manufacturing facility. So the contamination that they created at the site was wood preserving, typical wood preserving stuff on the southern half of the site, and organics VOCs on the northern half of the site. So it was a soil and groundwater deal. The site was listed because there was groundwater contamination in residential wells off site a long, long time ago when Tom and I were kids. The remedy for the site, there are five operable units. The first one was an interim remedy to contain contaminated groundwater at the property boundary. The second, third, and fourth operable units were source control remedies. So we contained the groundwater first. And then the source control remedies were soil and gravel covers over some of the old wood preserving areas, in situ soil vapor extraction, which kind of helped the groundwater piece, thermal desorption for some old Ricker units, and then solidification for what was called a south landfill, which is basically a big pit that they dug on the southern half of the site to find groundwater. And what do you do with the pit when you dig a pit and the groundwater goes away? You fill it up with waste. And so that's kind of what they did. And then the last operable unit was a catch-all, finalized the initial groundwater remedy, and selected M&A for the offsite area where the plume was. And so this pump and treat has been in operation since 1994, and it's done a decent job of cleaning up the offsite area. There's several locations that are still above the MCL. So EPA decided to change the remedy from pump and contain to in situ air sparging. So we're in the process of negotiating a consent decree with a PRP that went bankrupt in 2016 and is now closing their operations as of October the 3rd. So that's been interesting, to say the least. Where this redevelopment came from, November of 2012, the developer called me and said, hey, we worked out a deal with the local utility, Indianapolis Power and Light. The utility was offering incentives to develop renewable energy for their customers. And so the site owner at the time worked with the site owner to work a deal out with the utility, kind of like a PPA. And so they approached us in November of 2012 and they said, can we do this? They had never done this before on a Superfund site, asked if we would work with them, and they wanted to use this as a model, obviously, to do elsewhere. And so the first and most important thing that I did was to say, yes, we will work with you. And that was an answer that they really had not heard before from other EPA regions, because back then, obviously, we were very concerned about making sure our remedies remain protective. And so when I said, we will work with you, they said, great, that's awesome. So November 2012, we worked out, had that initial meeting. Worked out a deal with the developer where we sequenced the remedial design of this facility itself, the solar facility. I required they produce a soil minimization plan. They came to me and they said, we want to make the, and I got to be careful how I say this. We want to make the site fit the ramp, fit the redevelopment. And I said, we can't do that. We have to make the development fit the site. And what that meant was, they had to minimize the amount of soil that they had to regrade. They wanted everything to be flat because solar folks like to build stuff on flat ground. And in this case, the area where you see on the picture on the right, which is what it looks like now from the air, that was where their soil and gravel covers. So it's not a complicated remedy, but there's wood processing waste underneath. So again, they wanted to make it all flat. And I said, you can't do that. So they initially did a pilot test where they went out and the picture on the upper left where you see the racking and the pilings, the racking goes over the top, obviously, the pilings go into the ground. They did a pilot test to drive those into the ground to make sure that they would give them the strength that they needed to support the panels on top. And that's really, so sequencing the design, I approved it in bits and pieces to allow them to go out and do that pilot test. There was no exposure to the waste. If they had a piling that didn't give them the strength that they needed, they cut it off at ground surface and put another one nearby. So there was nothing, they weren't pulling anything out of the ground. So sequenced the design, ultimately came up with a plan that I approved, which included the soil minimization component. Obviously, our main concern was you can't mess with the remedy, you can't mess with the protectiveness of the remedy, you can't mess with the drainage, you know, coming off of the remedy itself. So the design obviously covered that. We also sequenced the remedial action. And what that means is that there are a number of components that they had to do. They had to demolish some buildings. They had to do some clearing and grubbing. They had to install the pilings. And so I approved those in pieces rather than waiting for, you know, for a big giant work plan with all of these things. I said, why don't you give me this piece first? I'll approve that while you're working on the next piece. So we sequenced the design. We sequenced the construction. Construction began in August of 2013, about a month before the government shut down for 6 weeks. And so we, I had my state guy on site watching the construction, you know, of the development. And it went pretty seamlessly. It was completed by December of 2013. They couldn't turn it on right away, unfortunately, because they had 8 giant $1 million transformers and one of them blew up while they were hooking it up. So they had to, wait to turn it on for a little bit until they could obviously replace that. Fortunately, nobody was injured when that happened. The incentives that the utility gave to the developer expired in December of 2013. So they worked out a deal with that so they could still get the incentives. This was a $25 million development. It's 14 megawatts over about 44 acres on the southern half of this site. So that's really, so from start to finish, from their initial call with me to when they were in essence done was 13 months, which for us, for EPA is rocket speed, light speed. As you see in the pictures, obviously the picture on the upper left is the pilings and then the racking. These were non-movable panels. This is the Midwest, so we don't get as much sunlight as in other parts of the country. So the fixed panels were picked. The picture right below that is actually cable trays that they hook all the cables to the panels up. And then the cable trays, they typically dig into the ground. And that was the other thing I told them they couldn't do. They had to have everything above ground. And this was back before that became commonplace. That is commonplace now because it's a lot cheaper to build these things. But back then they said, you can't have anything in the ground. So I think it's easier from an O&M standpoint. I don't understand why they didn't think that, but ultimately, that's a picture that I took, which I think is a pretty cool perspective of standing or sitting on the cable trays that the cables obviously went through from the panels up to the transformers and then up offsite. The picture on the right obviously is an aerial photograph of what it looks like. Why did this work? And again, Alexis, I'm going to make it within my 10 minutes here. This was the first utility scale solar site on a Superfund site in the country. Why did it work? Because EPA said, yes, we are willing to work with you. The developer was willing to change their plans by making the solar fit the site, cost them more money. By bringing the cable trays up out of the ground and above ground, as you see there, also cost them significantly more money. But they were willing to do that because they obviously knew that they could use this as a commercial to build elsewhere, which they have done. At a number of other Superfund sites and brownfield sites across the country. So they were smart enough to work to say, hey, EPA is being cooperative, so let's expend more resources so we can get this done, you know, in a cooperative way. We sequenced the design and the remedial action, which again, you know, when you approve a work plan, an overall site work plan takes longer than like a piece of the site kind of thing. So sequencing the design and sequencing the construction allowed them to build this and to turn it on, like I said, within that 13-month period. The pilot work that they were willing to do up front and to do everything above ground obviously made it easier for me to give them the thumbs up on what they were doing. The developer was incredibly cooperative and incredibly flexible with respect to building on a Superfund site, which they had to be. So that is why it worked. So Alexis, that is, you know, we'll take questions at the end, but I thought that this was a huge success at the time. Solar right now, everything is built above grade now because it's lighter and it's easier to do that. But at the time, again, they kind of pioneered this approach and have used it successfully and have taken credit for this at a number of solar conferences over the years. So that is Riley Tarr in Indiana. I'm also working on a site in Dayton, Ohio, where they're going to build solar on top of an old industrial landfill that we're finishing up construction. So solar is a good thing. Solar is easy, relatively easy to implement. And I say that from a governmental standpoint, it's relatively easy to implement if you work in a cooperative manner with a flexible eyes on the prize kind of developer. So that's my piece, Alexis.
Thank you, Dion. Amazing lightning speed. Thank you so much for sharing all that, kind of the details, especially how you manage the design aspects. I think that's really important to hear about. If you're interested or you're getting questions about alternative energy at Superfund sites, as Dion mentioned, it does happen all the time. And we put out an annual kind of report of things that happen. So if that's helpful, we can drop that in the chat. We'll have our next one out for FY23, probably late next month. But in the meantime, check it out. Yeah, it's a great opportunity. And we have lots of tried and true examples, thanks to folks like Dion who worked on that. Okay, I'm actually going to turn it over to Tom to talk more about the regional seed projects.
Yep, regional seeds and in-kind reuse planning. What regional seeds is basically when the cooperative agreement grant money ran out for us to get in-kind services, which was Ecology and Economics, Inc., which later on changed to SKEO Solutions, it was difficult to get money to work on projects. We didn't necessarily, we'd have to take it out of the pipeline. You'd have to go to your branch or your section chief, be very nice to them. These projects weren't very expensive. So it was, you know, maybe $40,000 to do a community planning project at the HOD landfill. But that money sometimes wasn't cost recoverable. It was difficult to get. My regional branch chief was willing to give me like $195K, just not 200, but $195K if I had enough projects to fund. Some other regional branch managers didn't want to give their redevelopment coordinator or their RPMs any money out of the pipeline to help with redevelopment. What happened then was headquarters came up with money, and that was the in-kind services. So that's why we have this, you know, when we talk about regional seeds, it basically means funding to fund through headquarters to fund Superfund redevelopment projects. And what I wanted to do is talk about, you know, these how we can, the other tools we have other than just reuse assessments and reuse plans. They're up on the screen right now, whether there's a situation assessment, there's alternative energy feasibility studies that we can do, there's ready for reuse determinations, climate resiliency assessments, institutional control and site restriction support. That kind of comes in with the SWARUs. We have a lot of sites that, and the only reason why they don't get SWARU is because the ICs aren't in place, because the ICs are all over the place and they're not done yet, and there's no deed restrictions. SKEO can help out with those things too. Also, technical and special reports can come out of these regional seeds. For sites and communities with potential environmental justice and equality concerns, tools can be tailored and built to build capacity for nearby residents to participate in redevelopment activities and benefit from site reuses. Tools that are available help build shared understanding of situations of conflict, support community leaders in their sharing of their visions for reuse with their community, and place community aspirations for reuse within the content of the regional planning and investments of that local area. The Superfund Redevelopment Program at headquarters provides support in these areas directly to EPA site teams and communities. We've got over 50 regional seeds going right now. And what I wanted to say on the side there was the ease and ability of this contracting process is incredible. I don't want to even let everybody know how easy it is, because I don't want to let the cat out of the bag. But basically, you know, if a developer or a city planner or a mayor came to you, an RPM, and said, hey, this guy wants to put a solar panels on this site. We want some assistance. Can you help us out? That RPM could come to me, and within maybe about a couple of weeks, I could have SCIO Solutions involved in a kickoff call where we're gathering information from the developer and from the people inside. So it's really good. It's not like the RPM's normal work assignment package where we have to do an SO, a statement of work, an IGCE, a work plan. We got to negotiate with a contractor. This is very easy to implement and get. It's easy to get SCIO out there and get them working. Next slide, please. So what makes a successful reuse project? I mean, sometimes people come to us. I have developers come to me and they're just trying to, they have get rich quick schemes. You know, they're just trying to do something out there. They haven't talked to anybody. Now, certainly I wouldn't go to the RPM and get them engaged and involved if we didn't think it was a legitimate kind of ask. So this is what that kind of addresses. There's no one size that fits all approach for supporting the further support that Superfund redevelopment program can provide to the regions, but there's criteria that we consider before we do it. But for example, will it in a project address specific needs of the community? If the developer wants to come in and put something in there, it's going to make everybody in the community angry. We don't want to promote that. You know, we want to be in with the community too. We want to make sure everybody's okay with that. And in the community that goes, we talk about divergent stakeholders. We don't want to just talk to the one that's speaking the loudest. We want to get a whole bunch of stakeholders out there. When I go and interview a stakeholder, at local, like planning commissioner or a soccer mom or anybody around the site, I always ask them, is there anybody else that you know that could be interested in this that I can talk to that can get me input? So then we can get a whole group of different people out there to get different opinions. You might say, well, that's going to complicate things more. You're going to have a whole bunch of people to deal with. But guess what? If you don't do it now, it's going to come back and bite you later on. So to get everybody on board and get a diverse group out there of everybody's opinions and what's going on there and talk it out is kind of important. Also, will the outcome support EPA's efforts for long-term stewardship? Are we going to have somebody looking over the site afterwards or will they abandon it? And normally when we do this, it helps with us to implement our institutional controls and helps to maintain the remedy's protectiveness. Does the project explore new problems or opportunities related to reuse that might inform future projects? Is it one that we can use as a model for later on or something like that? So that's what we kind of look at when we award these projects from regional seeds and what we look for when we look for a good project. What I was going to say is it also helps, you know, helps the team realize that there's going to require some kind of level of effort from the CICs and from our attorneys to go make this a successful technical project. If you don't have a good team and you don't have everybody on board and you ask for the funding to go out there, sometimes it can be more difficult because we're having internal meetings too. We want our internal team to be a good team together also. Okay, the next slide, please. So what happened was there was one of me in every region. When we first started out, everybody was doing things kind of differently, and we still kind of do. But basically, when somebody comes to us, a stakeholder, a developer, a mayor or something, or they come to the RPM and they come to us and stuff like that, we basically try to form a team inside with the RPM, the CIC, and the attorney. And we then try to have a kickoff call possibly with the developer, see what they have as a conceptual plan. A lot of times what I'll do is try to involve the state RPM in there also, because we got to get the state involved sooner or later, and it's good to get them involved right off the bat, see what the developer wants to do. And then we all kind of come back and strategize on how we can add value to the project and how we can move forward. We kind of identify like the pinch points and the parts that are going to be difficult. Well, in Region 4, what happened was Bill Denman and Kent West, they came up with a great process for doing this. It's called a prospective purchaser inquiry service, where it's like one call meets all, a great kickoff call. And what happens is SCIO Solutions will provide this service. I sat on my first one the other day about 2 weeks ago, and it was fantastic. Kent West is an attorney that was an EPA attorney. She works for SCIO. She helps to put together a team. We talk to the city managers and local developers. We get all this stuff out right at the very beginning. Everybody's on the phone, and it's a really good way to move forward. It's a best practice that the EPA site teams can use. that responding to inquiries from stakeholders. And what goes down in these PPI calls is we talk about the cleanup status and timelines, long-term operation and maintenance activities, potential for property restrictions and the ICs that we have potentially out there. Are there liens on the property, or can we remove the liens? And is there available liability protections? Liability comes up a lot in these calls. So with these calls, we can get up. EPA gets important information. The developer gets important information. And at that point, the developer has enough information. If he wants to walk, he can. But if he wants to go forward, he can do that too. And we also get to get into a little bit more about what the developer is planning is for his project and his time frames. And that helps us to anticipate challenges and obstacles out there. Next slide, please. Liability. A lot of times, after doing this since 1999, I try to categorize things in three different categories. The technical category, where we're talking about the protectiveness of the remedy and the reuse plans that and the conceptual plans that the developer or the stakeholder wants to use. The second one is the liability. Nobody wants to buy a Superfund site or operate on the Superfund site and pick up the Superfund liability. So that comes up quite a bit. And the third part is community outreach. You know, we want to make sure that we have our community involvement coordinator on board. We want to make sure that the city has talked to the citizens and developers on board with everybody that's around there. So those three aspects, technical protectiveness with the reuse, liability, and community input are like three major categories that we go with every one of these projects. So way that we've been addressing liability is through comfort letters. We have, you know, we provide a comfort letter. It summarizes, or they call it a site status number letter. It provides comprehensive information on the site status and other key issues, such as bona fide purchaser protection, reasonable steps, liability protection, and EPA lien information. These comfort letters are not legally binding. There's different types of model comfort letters, but a lot of them, most of them, the beginning part tells the person receiving the comfort letter that they need to make themselves a BFPP. The middle part kind of says, we've looked at your conceptual plan and there's nothing jumping off the pages as far as you're not going to poke through our cap or do anything. Like in Dion's case, if those piles were going to, for the racking was going to go down through his cap and hurt something, he wouldn't allow that to happen. Another part of the comfort letter is reasonable steps. We want the person that's taking the site on to take reasonable steps if they knock something over and it starts, you know, releasing, or they knock over one of our wells, or if maybe they found a pocket there of 55-gallon drums that we didn't see. If they find something while they're doing their development, take reasonable steps to stop it from flowing into the stream, give us a call. We want to make sure that you know that you're aware that there's reasonable steps out there. And then the last paragraph kind of, it says that, you know, it says that this isn't a legally binding letter. It says that this is a defense that you have to have yourself. If somebody comes to third-party lawsuit, you go to a judge, and the judge will determine that whether you've done your all appropriate inquiry and whether you're a good BFPP or not, and allow you that protection. EPA can't say, you can't give them their all appropriate inquiry and all the steps you have to jump through to be a BFPP. EPA can't write a letter saying you are a BFPP. That's not how it kind of works. The other thing is lien resolutions. You know, a lot of times there's two types of liens. There's a Superfund lien and there's a windfall lien. And EPA can address these settlements and through letter, these liens settlements through lien settlements. Superfund liens can be filed on site property owned by a PRP. They can be settled by a prospective purchaser in a lien agreement or a prospective purchaser agreement. The EPA can strategically use EPA liens, put EPA liens on property owned by PRPs to encourage prospective purchasers to contact the EPA before they buy sites, which results in good stewards which have appropriately managed their risks. Having an example where, you know, a developer bought 2 acres of land at an auction for real cheap. He didn't realize, they didn't tell him, it was on the Tower Lake Superfund site. He wanted to put up a sign there, a billboard sign. After he found out, he wanted to give it back. after, and then we sent him 104E requests, and then he started really freaking out. So, you know, we want to make sure that, you know, people come into these sites and they don't just buy them blindly. They realize that they're super fun sites and there's certain things that go with them. And then also the last thing is the settlement agreements. We have prospective purchaser agreements and the BFPP agreements. Prospective purchaser agreements are seems to be a stronger protection for liability. We get that it's stronger than a comfort letter. If a developer wants to get some kind of liability protection quickly and get going, comfort letter and status letter, I tell them is good. You want to take your time and you need an extra level of comfort with it, a prospective purchaser agreement might be a better thing. Department of Justice gets involved. It takes a little bit of time for us to get it through there. However, you give us something and we give you contribution protection from third-party lawsuits. So if there's PRPs on the site, you become the new owner. The PRP could sue you as a new owner. But if you have a PPA with the EPA, Department of Justice, that gives you contribution protection so that you can't get sued. So when we talk about, you know, with a developer and a development team, normally we'll ask them, make sure you got an environmental attorney there and make sure that attorney can talk to our attorney. Our attorneys can't give you advice. A lot of times they'll be on board and they'll talk to us, but the requester will ask for advice from our attorneys, and our attorneys will not. They can't do that. I tell them right off the bat that our attorneys can't give you advice. We can just tell you how to move through this process. The other thing is the ready for reuse determination. Is that on this slide?
It's not pictured, but you can go through it quickly.
It's not on there. Well, the ready for reuse determination is something that we came up with. It's kind of for stigma concerns. It's not a legal agreement. It kind of looks like a certificate, but we're not certifying anything. We're just basically saying that it's another tool that we've technically determined that the site is ready for some certain type of reuse. Commercial, industrial, recreational. A lot of times what we'll do is in the language of the RFR, we'll put down what the ICs are, what the institutional controls are. So that's good because the person that's receiving the ready for reuse determination, maybe the new owner, it clearly states what you can and what you can't do out there. And if you do something like use the groundwater when you're not supposed to, it nullifies this ready for reuse determination that we're having. Okay, so I got my thing saying we're way behind, but that's about it. That's all I wanted to say about RFRs, and we can go to the next slide. Thanks.
Thank you, Tom. And I don't mind at all. I love the way you explain things, so thank you so much. I appreciate it.
I just love the thing.
Yeah, I'll take it any day. Okay, we do want to do a quick knowledge check, and I feel like... Yeah, this is the one that came up before. So what will you do? I received a call from a developer that's interested in a site I manage. What should I do? Think fast. Let's see. Let's give it like 10 seconds or so. Are you going to A, inform the other members of the site team and contact your region's Superfund redevelopment coordinator? Your Superfund redevelopment coordinator is familiar with your region's processes and tools. B, ignore the request because Superfund sites cannot be used. C, contact HQ directly. The Superfund redevelopment coordinator does not need to be involved with an inquiry from a developer. Okay, shall we see there? How many are we waiting on, folks? Okay, let's see. All right, our work here is done. Thank you, guys. Okay, yes, that is exactly correct. That is what you do. That is, you find your Tom in your region and reach out. And, you know, they are all amazingly knowledgeable and passionate about this role. So let's go to the next slide. And we want to just make sure that is the key of this webinar is who you're going to call. But again, you know, we want you to, you know, as you're thinking about how to get started with this, let's say you don't even necessarily have a site in mind, or maybe you kind of do, or you're not sure. We have a web page. It's posted right up there. It has a ton of examples on there. It has a lot of our tools. I would look at, you'll see on the right side, it has like different roles of people. Like, I'm a developer, I'm a local government person, I'm a community member. And, you know, that's another way that you can look about it. But just take a look. We are going to probably move some things around there. But, you know, all of our webinars, all of our videos are there. We have a couple of good fact sheets and things like that, case studies, a ton of case studies. So we're really lucky there. Take a look, look at stuff that's specific to your region, or even about, you might even see something about a site that you inherited there and maybe just didn't have that history. So definitely you can look up yourself and your own sites on our website. And then contact your Superfund redevelopment coordinator. We will share that link again at the end of how you can see who they are, and please, please reach out to them. They are the people that will get you connected with the resources. Okay. So individual RPMs can't make that request. It's only your coordinator. Once you reach out to them, talk with them about what kind of support you might need. Just explain the situation and they'll probably have recommendations for you about your next steps. Then you guys can together, and it will be them sending the actual email, and it's just an email to me that just gives me, you know, the name of the site, a little bit about what you want, what you have in mind. And then you'll pull together your site team, including hopefully if you have a redevelopment attorney or just a site attorney, community involvement coordinator as well, and of course RPMs, and you guys can have a scoping call about the technical assistance. We can pull those off pretty quickly. You guys do not have to do any contract management responsibilities. The contract is in place and it's ready to go on a rolling basis for you. Let's go to the next slide. Maybe we'll highlight a couple of resources that you can take a look at. When you do go on our website, these are things to kind of keep in mind. We have done, and over the past year, translation of several of these kind of key documents into Spanish. So feel free to share them with, you know, members of the public, interested developers or community members. This one is one of our best, is the top 10 questions to ask when buying a Superfund site. So, and we have a webinar that I think we did on that maybe last year. So take a look. You also see some of the bottom of the directives that kind of support your work in this, and kind of provide some of the examples and the authority for you all to do this work as RPMs. Okay, next slide. I'll make sure we have some time for questions. Thanks. A couple other tools that are out there for you. One to highlight particularly is like this little map thing that you see on that laptop there. That's called the Redevelopment Mapper, Superfund Redevelopment Mapper. You can, all of the sites are on there, all of the boundaries are on there, along with a lot of information about infrastructure that could be of importance to people that are interested in using the site. It has things like highways and transmission lines and all kinds of other criteria. We are in the process of also taking advantage of all of the huge library of photos that we have of sites, and are adding, or we're going to be adding those to these entries too. So you can share this with people if they're, let's say they're looking, they don't have a specific site in mind, but they might have a part of the country that they're interested in working in and bringing, you know, their warehouse to, or what have you. And, you know, you can send them to kind of take a look at this and browse through different sites that are there. And let's see, I think this is, and these are kind of other resources. That's fine. You can go ahead. Thank you. I want to make sure we have time for a couple of questions at least. Okay. So again, we didn't talk about this earlier, but we kind of talked about some of the main concepts, just some do's and don'ts. We can share this around with all the attendees because it's not a public document, but it's just something that we put together for you all. So thinking about supporting reuse, work with everybody, help them understand, you know, when you are engaging external parties, help them kind of understand what information is available using things like the public prospective purchaser inquiry process or comfort letters, and which provides kind of a concise set of info. Don't be shy, reach out to people, and keep it in mind, use a reuse perspective to inform your cleanup process, and assess how the site might be able to provide, you know, benefits to the community that they might be missing. Let's see, on the other side, some big important ones. You can't make land use decisions or favor one kind of reuse over another. That's not our job. And like just like Tom was saying, bring all kinds of voices to the table because you want to make sure that we're being fair there. Don't exclude anybody, and don't assume everything is going to just stay the same. These are, things that happen over the course of decades, and we understand things change. You can bring us new requests about the same site, even if it's already been done. We understand that things change, and we're happy to help you and meet you where you're at. Obviously, don't infer that EPA owns a site property or assume that the current use is going to be the future use. So that's where you just really want to stay in touch with the community and get the pulse on that. Let's go. I think I have one more slide that maybe is our contact slide. Okay. Oh, this is we can put some of these in the chat and skip up, but we do put out a quarterly news update, so please sign up for that. We do webinars like this often. Some are public, some are internal like this. And we have an open house every month, which is just an informal Teams meeting that anybody can drop into if you have questions or you just want to kind of hear the latest about what's going on in the program. Next slide, please. Okay, and again, this link on the bottom where it says EPA Regional Redevelopment Coordinators is your most important one. So take note of your coordinator and reach out. If you are in Region 9, feel free to reach out to me directly right now while we line somebody up for that position. And I will make sure that when we get it filled, that person's gets filled up to date. All right. Do we let's see, time for questions. I'm sorry. Okay. Oh yeah, we don't yeah, they'll send you the links, Renan. In the meantime, are there any questions that we can take while we have Tom and Dion here?
Yes. So, I have a question from Gina Ferreira.
Okay.
She's a co-chair of a work group focusing on incorporating environmental goods and services into ecological risk assessments. She would like to know the authors of some of the documents you mentioned and if they would like to join the work group. So, if you'd be
Great.
open to that.
That was prepared by our team of our contracting team here under we do some reports like this from time to time under as part of like our economics work. And so I'm glad that you like it. You can contact me about that, Gina. And I can see if there's I mean maybe it would be me or maybe somebody else, but thanks for your interest.
Right. He says, will do.
Okay,
So
cool.
good. Yeah. And you can find your contact information on the registration page in case
Yeah, or it's right there
you
in
want to
the
know.
last slide, Rourke.Alexis. Yep.
Yep, right there.
Okay, thanks.
Perfect. Yeah. Okay. Next question. Is EPA required to approve developers' redevelopment plans? Dion said he pr approved plans for the site he was talking about.
I'm going to let Dion clarify that because I think.
Yeah, our really one of the things I didn't mention was that the PR or the developer asked EPA for a comfort letter. Originally, they were going to self-finance, and then they realized $25 million is probably more than they had originally anticipated. So their bank needed a comfort letter, and the comfort letter that we write to them says, or says, yeah, thank you. That what you're doing is not going to mess with the remedy. We don't formally, I approve the plan itself, but when it, the actual development, we say we don't approve the development. We say what you're doing is consistent with the protectiveness of the remedy.
Thanks,
Or
Dion.
doesn't mess with the protectiveness of the
Yeah,
remedy
right. Because again, it's not
in
our
a more
land.
official way.
Yeah, it's not our land. We're not the local government. We're just saying this is not going to mess with the cleanup. So that's all we can say. But yeah, thanks, Dion. Thanks for staying on. And I think the PowerPoint will be made available. It's tricky because this is an internal one, so we'll have to see what our options are for posting it. The recording and the materials, but I think we can certainly get you that.
Yeah, that will be also on the registration page if you go back after this webinar. So all those should be available there.
Awesome.
And I can post the link to the registration in the chat again.
Thank you.
Okay. So I have another question. Are ICS included and made searchable in SIMS? And is the ICS included in local repositories?
Okay, Rosemary, I think you're talking about ICs, right?
ICs, sorry.
Yeah, no, that's okay. It says ICS, yeah. But that's okay. Well, it is not a standard practice, but some sites do have ICs. I don't know that they're searchable in SEMS in terms of like what you would put in, but there are a lot of sites that have both. Kind of, there's like a checklist in SEMS that says what kind of ICs are applicable to the site. And then they also have the actual PDFs of some, but not all.
Alexis, they are searchable in SEMS. We have to make separate entries for each IC for a site for a 5-year review reporting process.
Okay.
So yes, you can find those. And yes, they are included in local repositories because they're property restrictions for the site in the community.
Yep. Thank you. And that's good to hear that. How do you search for them? Is there a special thing that you would recommend you search just when you're looking at the site, right?
I'm not a SEMS searching expert, but they all have their own separate numbers, the ICs themselves.
Okay, thanks. Okay, anybody else? There were two questions. Oh, go ahead, Raven.
Yeah. I was just going to do those questions. So I put in a few questions. Can we request more than one regional seed at a site?
Yes, you can. I mean, obviously, you know, we'll all be thoughtful about using resources wisely, but yes, there's not any rule that you can't, especially, I mean, you know, we'll take a look at the scopes and presumably they'll have different scopes of work or be doing very different times from each other. But because the whole point of this is kind of tying in what's happening with the site at any given time with what's happening in the surrounding community at any given time, both of those things change. And so we are open. Many sites have had more than one regional seed, and that is A-okay. It didn't come up in your question, but the funding for those projects, actually, it comes from headquarters. So I know Tom was mentioning a little bit of the cost information, but as far as regions are concerned, that doesn't come from your site budget or your, you know, other regional budgets. You can, if you'd like to, support, particularly if there's, you know, funding that you want to do for something around environmental justice or climate or something like that, and you have some funds earmarked that you want to contribute, great. But you don't need to. That's not a requirement.
All right. Thank you so much. Yeah. So I think it's about time to close things up. So thank you so much, everyone. Thank you to the speakers and thank you to all the attendees for showing up. I'm going to just do some closing remarks real quick. All right.
Thank you, Tom and Dion.
Mm-hmm. All right, so if you like this webinar and you want to go to more and register to more, please go to cluin.org. So we have a free monthly e-newsletter that goes out right every month. So you can go to Cluin Tech Direct and get on the listserv for that. So, and just to reiterate, so when you registered for today's seminar, you should have received a confirmation email with instructions to join us for the live event. We also sent these same details in a reminder email yesterday. Those emails will both point you to the seminar homepage. The seminar homepage is active from today forward, so I encourage you to save it as there are important pieces of information, including the session description, biographical information for our presenters, links to download presentation materials, as well as options to browse through related websites. There is even an option to provide feedback after our live delivery. Remember, this link will be available from today forward. To join us in the live broadcast, simply click the red button labeled Join Webinar. Yeah, it's like I said before. Okay. We often receive requests for PDHs and CEUs, but do not offer these hours for our events. Instead, you can download or print our participation certificate after submitting your feedback. Please be sure to enter email address correctly and then check the box at the bottom of the form to certify you attended live or replayed the event. Immediately upon submitting the form, you can download or print your certificate. So thank you for joining us. Let me thank again the presenters for their time and expertise. Thank you, Mike, for helping me out in the background, and all the support staff who helped to carry out our live delivery. Last but not least, let me thank each and every one of you for joining our live session today. We hope you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time, and we hope that you'll join us for future sessions. With that, I will formally conclude the day's live broadcast.